Hello, everyone, and welcome from here in the capital city of Austin, Texas. This is Capital Geek, a podcast dedicated to the founders and operators that create the products we love and turn them into fabulous companies with meaningful exits. Whether you're raising your first round of capital or racing toward an IPO, this is where we deep dive on the lessons learned from seasoned industry veterans, geeks of all types, the experts leading product and engineering teams, operations and finance, or sales and marketing, and we'll both learn from their mistakes and celebrate their successes while providing a roadmap for you to accelerate your own journey toward success. My name is Josh Stevens, CTO at Elsewhere Partners, and I am the Capital Geek. On this episode of Capital Geek, we celebrate TechOps Tuesday as we geek out with my good friend, John Grange, about scaling your CloudOps activities and the way that DevOps and cloud engineering teams have had to adapt to the work-from-home movement by innovating around remote technical operations. Let's get to it. John, welcome to the show. Thanks for so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
It's hard to believe that we've been running Capital Geek for as long as we have, and you and I have been working together for almost the same amount of time, but we haven't had you on the show yet, so I'm super excited to do that today.
I am too. You know, I've listened to a few episodes of the show, and I feel like today's kind of one of those long-time listener, first-time caller sort of things.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. You know, something we've talked a lot about within your capacity at Ops Compass, and we'll get into what you guys do there a little bit later, but it seems like every day I talk to more people that are finding new and innovative ways to work from home during this pandemic. But I think that the work from home challenge is so much nuanced when it comes to tech ops, you know, DevOps, security operations. Have you talked to many people that are doing that from home now, and how's it working for them?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them. And maybe recently you're seeing some more people start to get back into offices here and there. But I mean, for the last number of months, it's been these kind of cloud teams, tech ops teams that are managing these big kind of sprawling corporate cloud environments. They've been, you know, working from home, having to, you know, manage through deployments and bug fixes and all the things that, you know, people are used to being able to kind of collaborate in an office setting, collaborate with each other in person more often. And it's been completely remote the last, you know, few months.
I think for me, technical operations has always been one of my favorite organizations to work in because the energy on those teams is just so ultra high. And, you know, you're sitting shoulder to shoulder with your friends and you're troubleshooting issues as they come in from customers. And you really have your hands on the pulse, you know, of your application or whatever it is you offer to the market. And I think for me, it's one of those roles that is so much easier to do when you're in that sort of high energy, confined space type environment. Maybe it's because I'm such an extrovert where I tend to get a lot of my energy from other people. But for the people I've talked to, it's been super challenging to find a way to replicate that DevOps or TechOps sort of feel and vibe when everyone's working from home. Now, I've certainly talked to several people that, you know, work remote, and so they were always working from home. And for them, it sort of leveled the playing field in a way because, you know, before they were at sort of a disadvantage with communication with the teams that were there in, you know, in person. But now it's a whole new ballgame.
Yeah, and one of the things that's also changed now is, I mean, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, we all, you know, the software was already clearly becoming a really big part of the business, and in some cases was the business. But I mean, now it's even more so. You know, digital just drives, you know, whether it's manufacturing, factories, there's kind of old, traditionally thought of as old school businesses, ag. There's just technology and just digital everywhere. So I think one of the struggles is, to your point, these tech ops folks are kind of, they are the pulse of the business because most of the new kind of innovative revenue generating initiatives are driven by, you know, digital experiences, applications, things like that. And yeah, now everybody's having to figure out how to do that in this scenario where everybody's completely remote. And what I will say too is a lot of this, we'll probably get into it, but a lot of this new technology is very developer oriented, developer driven. And there's a longer sort of history and norm around developers working at home, at least in my experience, than kind of IT and traditional IT. I don't know what you think about that, but that's always been my perspective, at least.
Yeah, I think you're right. And what we're noticing now is that having some developer experience is a prerequisite for so many different roles. You know, historically, if we go back even 10 years, you know, your developers were likely to work in the engineering department, potentially within some sort of IT. But now you're likely to need development skills in marketing, in sales operations, within IT, within DevOps, within SecOps. It seems that that's become just a core competency for so many different types of roles. And we find, you know, data sciences, for example, in many cases are a long ways from IT, but they certainly need to have a technical background and the ability to write some code in order to do that job. I think the other thing that's driving it is when we were forced to start working from home, it also put us remote from our data centers. And so I'm seeing many organizations that were historically slow to migrate to public cloud just completely racing to transform their environment now, because they've realized that coming out of this situation, the need for private data centers will be even less significant than it was before. And if all of your employees are working from home and they're distributed around the country, it really doesn't make any sense to have all of your compute into one data center centrally located. And public cloud, I think, starts to make a lot more sense.
Also, in the pandemic environment, when maybe you took a material revenue hit in the second and or third quarter, that data center commitment and that hardware commitment is kind of a whole different ballgame than the consumption-based cloud spending models. So I think there's also even kind of a financial picture there for companies where they're saying, hey, let's take this opportunity to get out because, you know, the next pandemic, the next disruption, whatever it is, we need the business to be more agile going forward anyway.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, it not only does it move expenses from CapEx to OpEx, but it does give them that sort of nimbleness, that agility you're describing. And I think that's what many organizations are looking for today, is they're looking for some ability to be more nimble and to move around as this situation evolves. I talk to engineers from around the world pretty much every week. And what's interesting, I think, is that for a lot of the younger engineers who grew up with these communications channels, it's just as second nature for them to send a text message or a Slack message than it is to talk in person. I think even it's in some preferred. Cases, it's preferred, right? And so, you know, it's funny, I think a year ago, if we'd have walked into our DevOps shop and saw our team Slacking each other from the same room, we would have probably thought, well, that seems silly. Why don't you just talk to each other? But I think that digital first sort of communication style has allowed those organizations to more seamlessly transition into a work from home environment where most of your communication is done either in Teams or Slack, than those organizations that were slow to adopt those technologies. And for me, it's almost as good as being across the hall for someone else. I think there are still some gaps in terms of certain types of conversations that are much easier to have in person or maybe in an impromptu way. You know, it's hard to have an impromptu Slack video chat or Zoom session. But for the most part, I think it does a really good job.
I know I've really tried to encourage our staff to, hey, even if you just want to talk about the NBA playoff game, you know, from last night, Slack me, because we have to do our best to figure out ways to recreate kind of those sort of serendipitous interactions internally. The other thing, I just noticed this as we're talking, though, if you think about the few things that we really pointed out that have changed kind of in the pandemic environment, they're all really kind of existing trends like CapEx to OpEx and some of these things that we were talking about before, but it's the pandemic really accelerated it, exacerbated it.
Well, I think that's exactly what we're seeing. Yeah. What's been nice from an investment perspective is that most of the companies I've worked with and invested in were building products toward trends that this movement have accelerated. And so what I'm seeing now is not so much that there's a lack of desire to move to the cloud or to do more security and posture management, for example. But what there is there's a huge gap in skill set. And many organizations I've talked to, because they were slow to move to the cloud, they didn't really have their own cloud engineer or cloud architect on staff. And those resources are super hard to come by. You know, I think I talked to a different company who has DevOps openings at least twice a day, it seems like. And I'm seeing the same gap with product managers. It seems that those two skill sets are extremely hard to come by right now. And I think it's because organizations are learning to adapt and start sort of thinking about things in an agile way, the way that we all have for many years. And it changes the skill sets required. And so it's an interesting dichotomy that we have, you know, all this work happening while we're trying to work from home. And we're trying to adapt our businesses and in some cases even swap out our teams for, you know, more cloud savvy individuals. It's quite an interesting environment full of change.
Yeah, and it's not like for a lot of these companies in the cloud, you know, except for kind of the companies born in the cloud, they didn't necessarily set out in a deliberate way to go to the cloud. The cloud kind of happened to them. And then over time you kind of start to pick up some patterns and practices and things. And I think, you know, what we're seeing is the pandemic kind of accelerated a lot of digital strategies. It accelerated a lot of these remote kind of trends. And now you really need to have more of a deliberate kind of cloud strategy with the processes and the people and the expertise and everything to really stand up to it.
Those things really didn't exist 5 years ago. I mean, you could build it on your own, but the cloud environment has, in a lot of ways, just sort of become mature, you know. And you know, I can remember, well, I'm dating myself now, but even 5 years ago, it was very difficult to get visibility inside the public cloud, you know. And when organizations set out to build something like Amazon Web Services or Google Cloud Platform or Azure from Microsoft, typically they think about features first and how to gain market share, and security second. And somewhere way down the line, they think about management and visibility and, you know, whether or not what's happening within that system, you know, is observable or not from the outside. And what's nice about where we've gotten to now is that most of the vendors have rich API sets, and you can get to that management data to be able to find out what's going on.
Yeah, it's a lot better. I mean, in a lot of ways, we just kind of talk about the three cloud platforms as, you know, the AWS and Azure and GCP being the big ones. And then you have Alibaba, et cetera. But they've really all kind of gone through different generations. You know, one of the things that I'm noticing is 5 years ago, to your point, VMs were kind of underlying a lot of the even kind of platform as a services that were out there. And now VMs and infrastructure as a service, whereas a lot of people thought that maybe it would go away, it's actually kind of infrastructure as a service has taken on a greater importance with containers and some of these other more modern types of technologies. So, you know, in the name of like dating ourselves, like one of the things that I've kind of taken away from, you know, 15 years or so in this business is that kind of what's old becomes new again, just with a little bit of a different flavor.
John, do you ever use a Lucidchart?
Only when you've sent them to me.
Yeah, I've been a fan for many years, and today they released a new product called Lucid Spark. I haven't tried it yet, but I'm just checking it out. And the intent is for it to be sort of like Zoom, but for whiteboard sharing. So easy to collaborate, you know, easy to whiteboard from across the country with your team members. And I think that for me, the whiteboarding piece has been the largest piece that's hard to do when working from home. And then also, like I said earlier, these impromptu meetings that you'd like to have where you have an idea and you think, oh, let me walk down to John's office and chat with him for a minute. Maybe we end up at a whiteboard and the idea starts to pick up traction. So we walk down the hall and grab Scott, and, you know, an hour later it's getting late and we order dinner. And then an hour later we have some epiphany. I think I miss those types of interactions, and it's a lot harder to do via Zoom. But I think we're getting there. And yeah, it's really interesting. But I don't know for you, but I can say for myself, I've definitely become a lot more efficient at working from home and learning to collaborate than I was 6 months ago.
Oh yeah, I definitely feel the same for myself, and I feel pretty comfortable saying that most everybody at Ops Compass probably has too. But even with the whiteboard thing, which I think that we all have, right? Anybody who's in this software space, the creative space, the whiteboard ends up being huge. But even prior to COVID-19, I still remember one of our big kind of collaboration issues is the fact that we have multiple offices in multiple cities, and they have multiple conference room and multiple whiteboards. So it ends up, the whiteboards end up being, somebody takes a picture of it, somebody puts it into a Slack channel, you know, things like that. So there was already kind of this, a little bit of collaboration tension with whiteboarding because, you know, companies are sprawling all over the place, and now everybody's at home. So it kind of exacerbates that problem even more.
It's interesting because I think that for the last 6 months, or I guess seven now, we've all been trying to find ways to get work done. And I think our innovation has been focused around how to survive this new normal, how to get through the rough times. But I think that now it's time for us to start asking ourselves, how do we innovate on our products? How do we innovate on the problems we solve? How do we innovate for our customers? And several products in the portfolio that I deal with have begun doing that. You can really tell that the product has been enriched because of the new perspective that they've gotten by working with customers, you know, from their work from home environment. I think it also has an opportunity to be a little more intimate of a conversation. I mean, you get to see someone's home, you know, via Zoom. And I think that prior to this, when all you ever saw was maybe someone's cubicle, you know, if you're talking to a salesperson or something like that, you know, it humanizes the experience, I think, a little bit. You know, the fact that you see sort of where they live, you see them as a real person. We're seeing more and more people show up without fixing their hair, putting on their makeup, you know, whatever it takes to become just a more of a authentic individual. And I think that opens up a better line of communication. And I think the good products out there and the good companies, they always focus on having this really tight relationship with their customer and really trying to understand what they're doing. I think that in some ways epitomizes what the whole idea of customer success is supposed to be. But I think, you know, it was rough for a while for many companies, but we're starting to see some very positive momentum now.
Well, and for those of us that are building, you know, software for businesses today, you now have the sort of added requirement that it can't just be software that people want to use at work. It now has to be software that they want to use at home, because you're right. When you're working from home, even though it might be, you know, between 9 and 5 or whatever your hours are, it's a different environment. It sort of brings a human factor to everybody's workday that even I think from a software perspective, we have to appreciate and acknowledge.
Yeah, I think you're right. Let's talk a little bit about Ops Compass and, you know, why it's so relevant to the tech ops discussion. You know, I love the idea of doing a Tech Ops Tuesday on the podcast going forward, because I think that the tech ops community is widely underappreciated. You know, when you think about the last 8 months that we've had here, where we're on lockdown and we're working via Zoom or Microsoft Teams or Slack, and we're watching Netflix and Hulu in the evenings or Amazon Prime. Like, I've not experienced a serious outage with any of the systems I use in the last 8 months. I have had some temporary ISP issues here locally with some cut cables and stuff. But other than that, you know, it's been seamless. And it's seamless because, you know, there are engineers, there are technical operators servicing all of these companies we describe, and they're making it work. You know, they're essential personnel. They may be working at home in their pajamas, but they're keeping these systems up and running and performing nicely. You know, Ops Compass, well, I'll let you tell the story. Tell us a little bit about sort of why you decided to start Ops Compass and how it fits into this sort of tech ops world.
Sure. So Ops Compass kind of began out of a private cloud company that I co-founded a number of years ago called Layered Eye. And a lot of our customers, even though we were doing kind of enterprise private cloud with some niches where we were doing more contemporary platforms, but in an enterprise style infrastructure. So, you know, MongoDB, Docker containers, things like that in the late 2000s, when a lot of that was just starting to get big. We were doing that stuff inside of a traditional kind of enterprise data center environment. Well, our customers started to just really increasingly be asking about AWS, be asking about Azure. Some of them were starting to do a few things here and there in the cloud, largely virtual machine based, but starting to dabble in the cloud. So we started doing some projects with some large, a couple large multinational companies, actually. And one of the things that was really clear migrating some, we were actually migrating some huge WebSphere QA environments to Azure. With the corporate policies, the security requirements, the compliance requirements of a publicly traded company, and the fact that your entire stack in the cloud, from your application to your network to your storage, it's all software, it's all configurations. None of the existing tools worked. None of the processes really fit in. There was just all this sort of like incongruity. And it became very obvious to me that whereas maybe in the previous generation, there was an opportunity for, say, like a managed service or like a hosted managed service, with the cloud and with the robust APIs and kind of your ability to know the exact state of whatever it is you're looking for programmatically, the opportunity to me was obvious for software, that there was a market to build a SaaS application that was able to help you kind of at scale, keep track of all your little configurations and everything, but also make sense of them and help companies be compliant with all these sort of organizational rules that aren't always like regulatory. Some of them are just things that are corporate policy. So that's really where OpsCompass was born.
It's super fascinating. I invested in an automation company called Itential about 3 years ago, I guess. And Itential is focused around network automation. But as we were, you know, working with that company, and I actually filled in for a while as an officer of the company and helped them on strategy and marketing. But as I got to know the product and the customers, what I started noticing is that when it comes to automated platforms, be it network automation or cloud platforms and CI/CD processes, the numbers of changes that are needed to take place has just been exponentially increasing for years now. You know, and without good automation, you really have no opportunity to keep up with the numbers of moves, adds, and changes that are pushing out, the technology advances, cybersecurity threats, all the things that we're doing. And so what was interesting to me was when I saw OpsCompass for the first time almost a year ago, I guess, it answered some of the core questions that I get asked often by leaders of technology companies that are super hard to answer. You know, rough questions like, are we more compliant today than we were a month ago, or less compliant? You know, are we more secure or less secure? You know, do we know if we make a configuration change that might negatively impact our costs, you know, in some strange way? I think anyone who's been in the cloud for more than a year probably has a horror story of some configuration change they made, and a month later their bill shows up and it's three times what they expected, or at least some component of it is. And so I think that in a cloud world where everything is software configurable, I mean, your network runs as code, your security is code, your apps are code, the infrastructure is code in some sort of serverless microservice environment, it's your ability to manage the changes that are occurring in that code and give you a dashboard of where you have things that are changing or maybe rubbing up against a guardrail are just, it's super important. And I think that what really sold me is that as I started navigating the product, it could immediately answer questions that I had on a daily basis.
And one of the problems that customers have is sort of matching with their tech ops teams and their ability to sort of govern, matching the breadth of the cloud platforms. So it's one thing for companies, for an IT team to have to figure out the fact that in the cloud, you do a packet capture through an API. That's one thing. But, you know, being able to efficiently kind of identify and discover that maybe you have a problem with the way a storage account's configured, and all the way over here, maybe somebody upgraded a runtime on a serverless app. It's just such a wide range of things that can change that just that in and of itself sort of brings about risk. And it sort of changes how, as a team, you really need to treat visibility. So it can't just be sort of a temporal, we have visibility, meaning at some point in time, if we need to look back and see what happened, we can. Visibility needs to be more of a proactive, deliberate thing where you're making sure that the right people get eyes on the things that are happening in the cloud.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. If you're waiting and reviewing these things, you know, ad hoc on a periodic basis, well, first of all, you're going to be so busy, you probably never have time to go back and actually look. But when things are happening and something fails, or, you know, one of the things that keeps me up at night is worrying that someone may have left a public IP address on, you know, on an externally available host, or left a default password or something like that. You know, we're under a tremendous amount of stress and we're doing our jobs from home, and it would be expected that you might have a higher number of errors than normal, you know, maybe than what you had before. And so I think that having a product that provides a sanity check for the changes as they're occurring and lets you know as you start to deviate from normal, whether it's a security setting or some sort of, you know, IT policy, as we talked about cost anticipation, I don't know. It seems dangerous to run without something like this.
Well, you know what else is something that is that I see being really big with customers and sort of increasing in its uses, being able to identify human user activities and what happened and having context for it versus non-human users and what those non-human users are doing. So those non-human identities are your DevOps pipelines. It's a bunch of the cloud services that use service identities to do various things. It's really complicated. And there's, you know, lots of kind of identity things that customers are using on the edge, kind of CASBs and some, you know, other things like built into like their AD. But there's all sorts of apps and things out in the cloud, particularly in these infrastructure clouds that aren't connected into those systems. And that's very hard to get visibility into what's happening there, particularly as DevOps and automation becomes more and more exclusively the way that companies are deploying.
Yeah, I think it's a valid point. Maybe John, for those out there that, you know, haven't heard of CASB before, you kind of explain what you're talking about.
CASB, and it's very hard to get into all this stuff without a lot of industry jargon, right?
Yeah.
A CASB is a cloud access security broker, and there are some differences between them, but by and large, it's basically, if you're a company that's running a CASB, it sort of tracks and has some policies around what's coming through the browsers and things like that of the employees that are working there.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. You know, I was just thinking, if, you know, some of our listeners are junior engineers, we have everyone on the podcast from CEOs and investors to, you know, college and high school students learning their first code. If you were going to advise someone who, you know, was maybe a senior or junior in college and they're, you know, working on engineering in a STEM subject, but they're thinking about a DevOps career, you know, something in tech ops, where would you steer them right now in terms of the types of things to be focused on?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think that right now, anybody that has any sort of depth of knowledge of the infrastructure clouds is pretty valuable. I think that being able to go really deep into a couple of those services is big. But what I would say is looking at, I think all the operational issues and automation issues and everything surrounding a lot of these data-oriented services and the ML and AI services in the cloud is huge. When you think about how important data privacy has become with the, you know, the privacy laws in the European Union and New York and California, and the United States, et cetera. You know, the machine learning and all these different things and all these cloud apps, frankly, rely on having access to data to be able to do things with it. And increasingly a part of ops, just like we're trying to keep identities straight and track changes, there's going to be a need as we go forward to do a lot better job tracking data and what algorithms are learning on data and what are we doing with it. And I, there's you know, there's a burgeoning market of companies that are doing things there. But from a skill set perspective, I mean, we have a hard enough time finding people that are really kind of adept at doing kind of the DevOps and automation on basic stuff. But man, the companies are really moving into a lot of the data oriented services quickly. And that's where, you know, the data scientists are running the show, and they don't have a lot of traditional kind of computer science and technology background. They're data scientists. So I see that as kind of a gap within a gap.
That's a really interesting point. I think you're right. I think that that gap within a gap, as you said, is sort of a sweet spot today. It's hard to find people that have both skill sets. But you raise an interesting issue, right, where not only are you worried about who might have changed something from an individual perspective, but now you have ingestion of new changes from automated processes and microservices. And as you mentioned, you may have an AI or ML engine which is ingesting data and producing its own data. So being able to track back and see, well, where did that data come from? Was it something that was computed? Was it computational or was it AI driven? Was it input manually or how did we derive it? And follow that change from when that data was injected to your model all the way back. It's important. And I think that what I like about where the industry is heading right now is we're seeing a lot of maturation of sort of practices and tooling. And we're seeing, you know, a lot of new market labels like CASB, which you mentioned, or CSPM, which is Cloud Security Posture Management. But for me, it all sort of starts to boil up into this cloud operations management umbrella. And what's interesting is that what we used to think about as configuration management, primarily for network devices, because firewalls and routers have always been very config-oriented. But now we have that same sort of configurable nature for all of our infrastructure, our platforms, everything in the cloud, every application. And so, you know, there really is no physical representation of what we're building anymore. It's completely virtualized. It's all in the cloud and it's all code. And tracking how those parts interact and who has changed what over time is usually the number one way to track down a problem when you see it.
Yeah, and the you know, the dichotomy now of platform versus workload is really important, because I think that ends up affecting the type of teams that are working on, you know, whether it's the platform or the workload, the different types of tools you're using, the different problems you have. And I feel like, you know, in the past there was a tighter coupling between platform and workload.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're seeing it now. Cloud Security Posture Management is very much a platform level thing. And you have stuff like, you know, Cloud Workload Protection Platform, CWPP, it's acronym city here. And that's kind of workload level stuff. So that's where you're protecting, you know, a specific workload, like let's say a function app or an app service or a workload running in a VM. So it does add like kind of new dimensions and thus additional complexity that these teams kind of have to deal with now.
If you were, you know, working in an enterprise and maybe you had been slow to move to the cloud, but because of everything happening now, you're about to move a big data center into the public cloud. Like, what would be a couple of things to be sure that you would want people to be sure to do in terms of products they should think about or even best practices to line up?
Yeah, I think one of the big things is going to the cloud platform that you're adopting or the cloud platform you're going to land that workload on or those workloads on. And they all have what they call a cloud adoption framework. It sounds a little fluffy. I think kind of in the early days of those cloud adoption frameworks, they were fluffy. But I really think that Amazon and Microsoft and Google have done a nice job laying out sort of the path based on kind of where you are in adoption and what you need to do to sort of safely get to the cloud or expand your usage in the cloud or optimize what you're doing. So they kind of bring together architectural best practices, even a bunch of sample patterns, you know, secure configuration standards, a whole bunch of guidance, all the different things that you want to make sure that you don't miss about that particular platform. You know, even though they're all very similar, there is also key differences. I think that that's very much overlooked. I think that we've all been trained to think that a lot of that documentation and things like that on big company websites is useless. But if you think about it, these big hyperscale clouds, their whole business is about us never having to call them. So they have done, in my opinion, a really good job of putting that sort of guidance and documentation out there. So the number one thing I would say is to actually don't overlook those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's a really good point. You know, 5 years ago, those frameworks were very fluffy, as you mentioned, and the APIs were lacking. The visibility or observability wasn't there. It's a really good time to move to the cloud. You know, I think that even if you just talk about Azure, GCP, and AWS, you know, Microsoft, Google, and Amazon have done a fantastic job of building best-in-class solutions. You really can't go wrong with either of the three. They're good pros and cons as to, you know, when you're trying to pick one. But a lot of the struggles that I think we dealt with over the last few years in terms of lacking visibility, lacking these frameworks, have just gotten so much better. And I also think that it's easier to work with those vendors as you're planning a migration than it is after you've signed your deal. You know, I think that they spend a lot of time on the pre-sales side and on helping migration services. And my experience has been that those cloud providers are more likely to partner with you through that process when you're trying to get a migration done. And that, you know, they're a little bit harder to get a hold of, you know, post-migration once you're already in the cloud. But I think that's a really good point you raised.
And that's something that I've seen change. So I think a couple years ago, that's exactly it. There is a lot of, you know, support dollars from the big clouds to help you migrate there. And there still is, by the way, there's a lot of that. But, you know, Microsoft and Amazon have both, I really identified that there's sort of this plateau point. And that's really when companies start to consume more and more cloud. You know, when you're at 50, 60K a month on a platform, that gets to be a lot of stuff.
A lot to manage. Yeah,
it is. Yeah. And so what these clouds have realized is that, they've got to now start to not just help the customer get there, but they need to help them get through this plateau. And that's actually a place where OpsCompass has worked with the major clouds, actually, is with being a really solid way that they can go to their customers and say, hey, this is a tool that kind of helps you get through this plateau, get a better idea of what you have, build kind of what you have and how it's changing into your processes, things like that.
Yeah, I've talked to two types of customers for OpsCompass. I've talked to customers that got involved early, pre-migration, you know, bought the product and have worked with us through that migration. And they probably didn't see a plateau in that case because they have the management tools handy. And then I've talked to other customers that did exactly as you described. They start rolling out cloud resources. They hit a plateau when things become sort of unmanageable, when it becomes almost too much to handle. And I've even seen some companies use that as the point of when to diversify and choose a second cloud provider. Because it's almost like, well, it's easier to just have a second provider in a separate ecosystem than it is to be able to manage one ecosystem with, you know, 100,000 resources we're trying to manage.
Yeah, the common one that I've seen is kind of the situation where, you know, hey, we've got we spend about $2 million a year on AWS. We're trying to get the governance and security under control. And now there's a need for Azure. So we're now going to just build a whole corporate multi-cloud sort of security, you know, really multi-cloud operations management program. And I think some of it comes from, you know, a $2 million spend with AWS is a lot of AWS, but for a decent sized company, it's not a big piece of the IT budget.
No.
So it sort of struggles to bubble up to that strategic importance at the executive level. But once it does, then there's always a big effort to have a very standard security, compliance, and governance program for the cloud.
Yeah, I think what you said was really interesting there, because what you described is what I'm sort of excited about. I'm excited that people are starting to think about cloud operations management strategically. And if you have an enterprise and you have a multi-cloud approach, and I've talked to several tech companies that are pretty small, you know, under 100 employees, that also have two or three public clouds within their ecosystem. You know, building out that operations management approach within your processes and methodologies, getting the right tooling, getting your team trained for the right things is going to make a huge difference. And while it might not seem like that big of an investment, the fun part about cloud is that you can spend your way into it very slowly and gradually. The dangerous part about cloud is it's out there in the public, in the wild, and it's available for anyone to try to get after. And so you don't want to be the person who accidentally leaves the back window open and lets someone sneak in and steal data. Those things happen more and more every week. And I think it's a super important part of how you manage your multi-cloud operations in terms of how you think about managing your risk, and especially around security.
Yeah, and the tension there is that it'd be really easy to come in and just treat your cloud like you did your data center and just sort of create a bunch of deny rules around the perimeter, right? And just take everything you just don't want to have happen and just deny, deny, deny. And a lot of the reasons why companies are going to the cloud is to be able to iterate faster,
yep,
try things more quickly, be more agile. So that doesn't really work. So a lot of the core problem and the core tension is actually from that. It's, well, how do we know what we should have a deny policy on? And how do we, you know, it's really that guardrails versus gates discussion.
That's super fascinating. Maybe we make our next segment together, guardrails versus gates, and we'll get into that a little deeper.
It's a good one.
We're pretty much out of time, John. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
That's it, everyone, and thank you for joining Capital Geek. Subscribe via Apple, Stitcher, or any platform where you usually find fantastic podcasts. Tune in again soon for another great episode of Capital Geek.